Well, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, July 13th, 2015. This was the week in which former Congressman Tom Tancredo, one of the most vociferous critics of our immigration politics, told Donald Trump he should take it down a notch. True story. Well, thank you for joining us here at Week to Week, our San Francisco offices. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about the fallout from the tragic murder in San Francisco and the light it has shown on the sanctuary city policy. We'll check in on some presidential campaign politics, of course, some of which don't involve Donald Trump. We'll discuss why America finally likes soccer. And we'll talk about the continuing political changes wrought by the Confederate flag flap, say that three times fast, and as well as other political news and views. As usual, any opinions expressed up here are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the Commonwealth Club. In fact, probably not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there with Melissa Griffin Kane, a contributor to CBS SF, also in San Francisco Magazine. She's also an attorney, and she's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. Next to her,
Melissa Kane was taken. Sorry.
Is there a Melissa Kane 2?
Not yet.
Okay. That handle's open, so someone take it. Next to her is Doug Sovereign, a political and investigative reporter for KCBS Radio. He's on Twitter at Sovereign Nation. And next to me here is C.W. Nevius. You can call him Chuck. He's a columnist at San Francisco Chronicle. He's on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit any questions or to fan yourself, to keep yourself cool. It is warm today. I will try to ask as many of the questions as possible. So on to our roundtable, and it's a pretty sober question to begin with, or a pretty sober topic. No city likes to be in the national news because of, you know, a senseless crime. A couple decades ago, it was usually New York City, you know, that was getting this treatment. Due to infamous incidents such as the Central Park jogger assault, you remember that, or the adulation that John Gotti was getting when he was on trial for various heinous crimes. So here in San Francisco, an undocumented immigrant who was released from prison by the name of Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez was charged with murder for allegedly shooting a 32-year-old woman July 1st on the Embarcadero. Federal immigration authorities have complained that San Francisco ignored their request to hold Lopez Sanchez, who is an undocumented Mexican felon, so that he could be deported. So first, let me go to the lawyer on our panel, Melissa, to explain, first of all, what is a sanctuary city policy, and what does it mean and what doesn't it mean? I think a lot of people aren't sure what it exactly entails.
Well, I just want to point out that Doug is basically a lawyer in light of his family of lawyers and all of this, so I'm sure he'll have lots to say too. But so sanctuary city is a term that's used, but it doesn't really have like a legal definition, right? It could mean any number of sort of pro-immigration policies that cities adopt. And initially it was adopted because people in the immigrant community were scared to go to the police to report crimes or to be witnesses to crimes because they thought that they were going to get immigration called on them, right? So in order, the idea was, in order to facilitate that communication, we're going to sort of declare our local law enforcement, you know, sort of hands off on that sort of thing, so people aren't fearful about going to them. So San Francisco's sanctuary city policy, what was referred to is this 2013 law. This is kind of usually what we're talking about. This 2013 law that says we don't detain people based on immigration requests unless the person has a serious violent felony past and they've also been picked up for a serious violent felony. Now, that exception doesn't get Francisco Lopez Sanchez. It doesn't get him because he didn't really have this violent history. So he was sort of outside that exemption. But one thing I want to make clear is there are sort of two things we're talking about here. One is the detention part, which is kind of dicey, right? You're holding someone, whether without a warrant, it's not clear. But the other is the communication part, because the request that the Homeland Security submitted didn't just say, hold this guy. It said, call us before you release him. And when you talk to Sheriff Mark Grimm, he says, well, I couldn't detain him because of the law. I go, yeah, but you couldn't, why couldn't you pick up the phone? There's nothing in the law that says you can't communicate that you're about to release this person, especially someone with the kind of history that this person had. So to be clear, there is nothing in the law that prohibits a telephone call. Again, it does say we don't detain unless there are all these sort of serious violent felonies sitting there. So that's generally what we're talking about when we're talking about the law. I do want to make it clear that that exception for serious violent felons expires in 2016. And it was opposed very strongly by Supervisors Avalos and Campos, who did not even want a serious violent felon exception in the law. And I will tell you, Sheriff Mogherini spoke out in favor of the law before the exception was put in. So I know he's saying a lot, what do? I just, there's this law. Well, you were at the Board of Supervisors really, really in favor of this law before there was even an exemption for serious violent felons. So just to give you a little bit of the landscape of how the law came to be and how that exception came to be.
Doug, let's talk a bit more about what this means for Ross Mogherini. I mean, he's got a colorful reputation anyway.
That's one word for it. Let me just add a couple of points. One is actually the original sanctuary city law goes back to, I'm older than you are, goes back to the mid-80s. Some of you may remember when you had refugees from El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and the Reagan administration was not deporting people from the country where they supported the government and was deporting people where they didn't. So it started in church basements in San Francisco. To literally give people sanctuary, and then the city passed an ordinance to say, well, we won't even cooperate with immigration authorities, and then it was expanded later, and it's grown into what it is now 30 years later. But Mogherini, yeah, he was a strong supporter of having the San Francisco law. There's also a state law, the Trust Act, which was passed last year, 2014, which says essentially the same thing at a statewide level, except the governor insisted on a long list of exceptions. So in that case, if you just have a felony conviction or you are wanted on a felony, charged with a felony, they will cooperate and turn you over. So if it had not been in San Francisco, it had been somewhere in the state that didn't have the more stringent law, Lopez Sanchez would have been surrendered. But San Francisco has its own law that goes beyond that, that says, no, it has to be a violent felony, which he had only drug convictions and immigration convictions. But Ross Mogherini, he was a strong supporter of having this law. He likes to have things both ways. He's had a lot of bad things happen on his watch. He's running for re-election. We unearthed some tape from a campaign debate in March where he, you know, now he's saying, well, if they'd only given me a court order or a bench warrant, I would have surrendered him, of course. But in fact, in March...
You have a little Ross Mogherini going there. That's pretty good.
But in March, he said, I am very proud to say that I'm the first sheriff to say no ICE cooperation, no Homeland Security cooperation. And he bragged that he at his department had gone farther than the mayor when the mayor expanded the law and said, I trumped him because the mayor left the door open for ICE and I've shut that door. That was 4 months ago. Now he's saying, well, I'm just doing what the law says. And in fact, he has gone beyond what the law says, and it's open to some interpretation because the law, as Melissa said, does allow communication. There's nothing in that law that says he can't pick up the phone and say, hey, we do have this guy, you want him, whatever, we'll turn him back. So that's where it stands.
So Chuck, is Sheriff Mogherini's, I mean, is this game up for him politically?
Well, first I'd like to say that my daughter is going to law school, so I'm almost a lawyer too. we were talking the other day. People would come up and say, do you think Ross will be reelected? And now people are saying, do you think he'll make it to November? You know, it's been an unbelievable run. I don't know, maybe some of us are old enough to remember Little Abner and the guy Joe Bitzvick who had a cloud over his head. It's kind of Ross Mogherini. He's kind of walking around with this cloud over his head. But this is the law of unintended consequences. By standing up like this and making what he thinks is going to be a big play for San Francisco, when something like this happens, now we snap back. I just watched the Bill O'Reilly show with the Steinle. Well, the Steinle parents were on, the people whose daughter was killed. And what they've said is, what now they're on the bandwagon. I would also say, talk about a national story, John Diaz, our editorial editor, was in New York this week, and the Pier 14 news was on the ticker in Times Square. So, I mean, They were specifically saying developments in San Francisco.
It's been the lead story on the New York local news. They're treating it like a local story all across the country.
So given that, now we've got Ross Mercurimi saying these things, and that gives an opening for everyone. And Bill O'Reilly's thing today was that they're going to start a thing called Kate's Law, which would be based and in memorial to this woman who died. And her parents, who are extremely sympathetic characters, are in favor of this. They think this is a good idea. But the idea is that you would get a mandatory 5-year prison sentence if you returned to the United States after you'd been deported and if you were a felon, which goes back to what we were talking about to start with. It's rife with the potential for abuse, for overuse. I mean, one of the reasons we had sanctuary cities were that women would report domestic violence, and then they'd be deported. I mean, it's just a real concern. But the point I was trying to make is that by standing up and making such a show of how we're not going to cooperate at all, this government agency is not to be trusted, you've opened the door for this, and this is what we've got. So moderation, communication, and Ed Lee, the only good line I've ever heard him say, do I have to teach someone how to pick up the phone?
He got kind of dicey on this.
Yeah.
Ed Lee, who's like this smiley mustache guy, like actually like really kind of got angry. It was really jarring.
Yeah, he pushes the love loss there.
Yeah.
And you think of the previous sheriff we had, Mike Hennessy, who, 24 years, it was a sleepy backwater, nothing ever happened. He just ran the ship of state. And Mercurimi, there's been, 4 major scandals in 4 years since he's been sheriff. It's incredible.
We were mentioning the underwear guy. You saw the guy that was sent out to take out the trash and just took off his prison suit and just took off. He turns out to be an international drug dealer who was facing federal charges, probably going to be in prison. Haven't seen him since. He's just gone. And that was the second guy in 9 months. I mean, all you have to do is run the jail. That's really your job here. Let's just do that.
So what is the federal... I mean, are cities required under federal law to comply with ICE requests? Or... it's just like you'll get this suggestion randomly from the federal government. I would assume if the federal government is requesting something, it's not a real request. It's a do this. Or I'm looking at, again, the only one who holds a bar certification here.
Well, so in certain circumstances, right? So when you get that, this is getting a little technical, but basically when ICE sends a detainer form, I think it's like a form 427 or something like that. They send the form and then they tell you sort of why they want you to detain the person for 48 hours. And one of the reasons is we are thinking about investigating this person. And a court in Oregon said, that's not good enough. We're not holding anybody because you're considering investigating them. No. But there's also some other boxes on there. And one of the other boxes says, for example, there's an order of deportation. And that's a legit court order. You should comply with that. Now, we're not sure whether that happened in this case. We're still not sure about the grounds that they set forth for why they wanted the detainer. But it actually kind of varies depending on the reason that they're giving. Now, to be fair, there are federal statutes that say we rule immigration. The federal law is, the federal government rules immigration. You don't really have a choice whether to comply with us, whether to do what we ask you to do. But those are sort of big umbrella rules that don't really get enforced that much, right? And the federal government, especially under President Obama, has been pretty pretty cool with letting cities do their sanctuary thing. So technically, yes, there is a law. You guys probably you remember back in 2009 when David Campos wanted to pass a law saying we don't report juveniles who get arrested for felonies. He passed a law over the mayor's veto. Newsom vetoed it. He passed a law saying when we arrest a juvenile, we are not going to report that person, until they're convicted. But the law never took effect. And the reason why it didn't is because a federal, a U.S. attorney launched a grand jury investigation into our flouting of, again, those sort of federal umbrella laws. And so the sort of butting up against one another kind of situation you had there meant that the law never took effect. And then later we started doing something called secure communities and sort of eliminated the issue of reporting. But at the time, that was the exact issue, was what do you do when you have federal laws that say we cover the whole field and you have to do what we say, and then you go and do something like this?
But my thought of that is that when you hear states' right conservatives and even local conservatives who just refuse, who will say, I'm not listening to the federal government on, you know, land management. I'm not, you know, they're wrong on, we'll get to this later on, you know, same-sex marriage. The Supreme Court's not, you know, supreme. You know, they talk about nullification of federal law. And frankly, liberals are upset by those things. And here it's kind of like, oh, but we're not.
Well, remember, too, again, the Obama administration really has not been big on pressing this issue. Potentially, a chief executive could make this a priority. He just hasn't. He's just said, like, let's just focus on the criminals. We're not going to.
President Donald Trump will make an issue. So this can only go on so far.
Oh, dear.
There's always a lot of selective nullification. I mean, states' rights is convenient when it's your issue. And
it's in the eye of the beholder.
You know, I mean, you could argue some of this could be laid at the Republicans' doorstep in Washington because there's not been comprehensive immigration reform. And if there were, you wouldn't need cities and states to pass their own laws and have this patchwork quilt of what applies and what doesn't. If there was a comprehensive law and everything were implemented properly.
Deborah's not here, so I'll step in.
Okay.
That's saying, basically, Republicans are not giving us the change in the law that we want, therefore, it's their fault that people are disagreeing with the way things are and doing their own thing. But Republicans might, you know, a Republican idea of immigration reform might be to restrict it even further, in which case these sanctuary cities and that movement would continue, if not
potentially. Yes, that's true.
Brought back the question of federal funding, right? For years and years, since I think 2008 at least, it's been part of the Republican Party platform that sanctuary cities or sanctuary states should get their federal funding cut. That we should not get grants for law enforcement, not like for food, but you know, like for you know, for like for law enforcement and other kinds of law enforcement related. Things, no more federal money if we're going to be a sanctuary city. And that has come back up again. Senator Cotton has now introduced a bill that would do just that. So instead of comprehensive immigration reform, we're getting
sanctuary cities.
We are getting potentially the end of federal funding.
You know what I would say too, because I'm not a lawyer, but what I would say is so much of history happens by happenstance. And the fact that on Sunday, I ran up to Pier 14 and went out to where she was shot. And that was a terrible, awful event. But the odds that that would have happened at the end of the pier, this wild shot out of nowhere while she's standing next to her dad, and yet that turns into the match that starts the firestorm on this whole thing, a little bit like, and we'll get to that later, but the Confederate flag. If the people hadn't been shot in the church, we might not have gone to the Confederate flag. You never know what's going to set something like this off, and now everybody's scrambling. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden we scroll everything back and say, well, what's the federal responsibility? What's the city's responsibility? Who, you know, who's at blame? Who has to do these things? But that incident was such a horrible coincidence that happened, and now, like I said, it's a national debate.
I think one of the reasons it has struck a chord with so many people is this tragic thing that could happen to anybody, and there are so many layers to it. The gun was stolen from a federal agent's car, and he says he found it. We don't know where he really got it, but and the woman, I mean, it could have been her father who had been shot. It happens to be her. She's a beautiful young woman. He turns out to be an illegal immigrant. I mean, there's all these layers to it, and it's just tugs at your heart.
The story of the gun is so suspicious, and that he got sleeping pills out of a trash can, and then what was he doing with the gun? And again, I don't know where he was, but that bullet could have gone anywhere. It could have hit Alcatraz, which it would have been just as likely.
I covered his arraignment the other day, so I was in court watching him, and this is a guy who, I don't know if it's substance abuse, mental illness, lack of intelligence. He's not all there. He does not seem to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. He just didn't seem to even understand.
I don't think we know.
The version of events he gave the cops is he found the gun and he was using it to shoot at sea lions and he fired
one shot.
Because
that's what you do.
And it accidentally hit her. The version he told two local reporters was, I found the gun, and I picked it up, and it went off by accident, and it went off two or three times, although she was only hit once. So one version is he actually fired it. The other is he said it went off by accident. The DA has decided to charge him with murder because they believe it was, at least they're charging it for the, it may lead to a plea deal later, but for the purposes of prosecution now, intentional, willful, he fired the shot. It was not an accident. We don't know really what happened.
Okay, so we've talked about the effect this could have Sheriff Mercurimi. In fact, someone asked the question you kind of addressed. Did the mayor throw Mercurimi under the bus when he criticized the lack of a phone call by Mercurimi?
He certainly tried to. He's tried it many times. Yes. The bus has not hit Mercurimi yet, but it's
the mayor's at the wheel.
It's due in a few minutes.
A bus, a truck, a train.
Okay. What about California Attorney General Kamala Harris? She spoke recently, defended sanctuary cities. Is this a political liability for her, Chuck, do you think?
Well, I think she feels very strongly both ways, right? She's going to try to play this as, you know, her interview to the Chronicle was, I support sanctuary cities, I support the idea, and I support the idea of letting local municipalities make their own decisions. And then she sort of looked around like, is that good enough? Because I hope it is, because that won't offend anybody, right? I don't know if she's going to have to make a decision. And it'll be interesting to see if she does, how she comes down on this. You know, the one thing, we haven't gotten to Trump yet, but the one thing that people said about Donald Trump and popping off like this is it forced Republican candidates to take a stand. They got to say, do you stand with this or not? And if you don't, let's hear what you have to say. And I think that's similar to what's happened with this. Mercurimi's toast. But while we're serving breakfast, we'll also find out more about these other politicians. And I think that's going to be worthwhile because they're going to have to answer a very specific question.
You know, having said all that, I mean, here's what's sort of interesting is that the members of the Board of Supervisors I've talked to don't have any plans to amend the law. Like, there's no change on the horizon, despite the fact that polls show that people would like it to be reined in or maybe the exceptions made larger. There doesn't seem to be any real movement at the top and with our representatives on any level to actually make a change to the law.
Mayor Lee has said he's going to review and investigate, and if changes are necessary, we'll propose them. And Mercurimi even said he would support discussing amendments, but they may all hope that...
Support discussing?
Yeah. They may all hope that this sort of blows over, dies down, and no one has to do anything as far as changing the law. Or maybe the law will be changed and that they'll change that list of what's exempt and what isn't, that sort of thing. You know, they'll tinker with it a little bit.
And again, Chuck? Watching Bill O'Reilly tonight, they're planning on flying the Steinle family to Washington, D.C. after the August recess to advance the idea of this bill, Kate's Law, and put them in front. I mean, I don't think it's going to die down. They're going to ride this like a pony. So it's going to be, everybody's going to have to figure out what they can say about this and what their opinion is. And
Chuck gets all his best stuff from Bill O'Reilly, by the way.
I was once on Bill O'Reilly's show. It was one of the most terrifying moments of my life. Yeah.
We'll do a special podcast with that reminiscence. Let's move on to our next topic, and this is, I was going to say less tragic, but let's talk about the lineup. This is the presidential race for 2016. There are now, if someone actually asked, are there any Republicans who are not running? Is it 17? Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker announced again today, this is actually his second tweet on it, and as I understand, on the first, or I don't know if it's going to be all of the debates, but at least the first debate, only the top 10, the ones who are polling obviously the best, will be on that stage. You can all really, I mean, you might as well make the popcorn and chill the wine now, because Donald Trump will be on that stage, on that debate. But let's actually start with the new guy in the race today. Excuse us while we try to...
Yeah, first of all, if you get asked in a poll, say you support Donald Trump, let's make sure he's on there. Let's make sure he's...
he'll qualify, no. He won't have any problem qualifying. George Pataki won't get on that stage, but Donald Trump will be.
I like the sound of that.
But let's start with Scott Walker. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is in the race. He has been polling very well in Iowa, I believe in New Hampshire as well. Chuck, he's kind of an outlier. One of the things I find interesting about him is, in terms of like personal wealth, he probably matches up with more Americans than any of the other candidates there. He's got thousands and thousands of dollars in personal debt. His net worth is lower than it would be if he owned a two-bedroom fixer-upper in a downwardly mobile neighborhood of San Francisco. Seriously, he's he's not a wealthy man.
That's partly because he's never done anything but be in politics, so hasn't had a chance to make any money.
Some of them find ways to enrich themselves
quite a bit
in
of
that.
Money, I would say that.
But what do we know about Scott Walker as far as what we can expect from him? I mean,
well, I think he looks presidential, and I think that's a start. He steps up there, but then I think he is kind of a cipher. I'm not sure people really do understand. And the mm-hmm. idea of a man of the people thing is a bit at odds with his union stance, which has made big waves in Wisconsin. So I'm not sure. He may be one of those people that I liked him when I met him, and then the more I heard about him, I'm not really sure I do. But it's such a dull race. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Jon Stewart thing, but he played the clip that Donald Trump about how they're raping, they're murdering, and some, I assume, are very nice people. You know, he said, and he said, of course, Jon Stewart said, and after that kind of thing, you can imagine what happened to his poll numbers. And then he showed the poll numbers, and he went up to number 2 in the polls. So, I mean, so many people are playing it so safe that it opens the door for a guy like Donald Trump, a Ted Cruz, all those people who can just throw bombs and go back and forth and throw red meat to the crowds. I don't know, Scott Walker. Nobody's taking this by storm, that's for sure. So Scott Walker may have as good a chance as anyone.
Yeah,
Scott Walker, he's a formidable candidate. I mean, I have him in my top tier along with Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. I mean, I think those three are the ones really to watch. And Scott Walker, 2012 convention, he stole the show there. He got a rock star reception. They love him. The conservative base of the Republican Party, they love everything he stands for. He's very good at raising money. He's never lost an election. He fights against all odds. That's what he's going to play up. He's got this Midwestern appeal. He was born in Iowa, but obviously he's lived in Wisconsin most of his life. Doesn't have a college degree. He'd be the first president in a very long time. I think Harry Truman probably, the last one without a college degree. He'll play, you know, you got the anti-intellectual populist thing. He's going to play very well. The question is, does he have the gravitas? Does he have any foreign policy knowledge? Can he move beyond the Midwest and the conservatives? But I think he's the rare sort of Midwestern, Northern guy who can play in the South. He's one to watch very closely. I think he's going to do very well.
Melissa, are you jumping on Team Walker?
It's been really interesting to watch him, but like Chuck, it's one of these. Y'all remember when Fred Thompson was thinking about running, and everybody's like, "Fred, get in the race!
That's
Fred, get in the race!"
Example,
and then Fred was like, "I'm running," and everyone was like,
"That's a great example."
Wow, we're not that crazy about you.
Yeah.
So
they were kept looking for a savior. And they thought, oh, maybe Fred Thompson, Law and Order, yeah, get him out there.
But we're still looking for a savior. Yeah. By a savior, I mean someone interesting.
Right. Yeah.
So
Trump is interesting.
I think people, well, I just mean, like, but, you know, normal.
Yeah.
I think it's one of these things that people really wanted him to get in the race, and because he did all these, like, really extraordinary things in Wisconsin. I think Republicans especially think it's extraordinary. But I have to agree. I think once he's in and you see him talk a few times and again, he tries to speak about foreign policy or something, it's going to be like, oh, boy. But Chick, please. So I'll tell you, but he's still in my top three, and that's just because of the weakness of the field overall, right? It's not that he's that great. It's just he's, like, less bad than a lot of other people in terms of, like, their popularity and their staying power.
He's also really polarizing. I mean, Wisconsin, you have progressive, very liberal Democrats and fairly conservative Republicans. He is loathed by half of Wisconsin, and they will tell you he's done horrible things with the budget, and it hasn't been all smooth sailing for him there. But
and
that endears him to the Republican primary voter.
And it's always, it is, as a sitting governor, you're always at a disadvantage because you've got everybody back in your home state, and you've got a very sort of built-in anti-Walker, you know, mantra, which is, where are you? Why aren't you minding the store? Your budget stinks. We hate what you're doing. So, you know, there's this sort of built-in animosity toward a governor who's out, you know, campaigning as opposed to running his state. And so it's always a little tougher for a sitting governor to run. So he's got that not going for him.
And I think what you said about, you know, Jeb Bush went through that too. He looked so appealing when he popped up. You know, there's someone with some gravitas. And then the more people heard about him, and he was against Iraq, for Iraq. He couldn't decide if his brother should have done it or shouldn't have done it, you know. And I think the amazing thing is that Karl Rove was on my favorite show, Bill O'Reilly, that I've now watched once. And he was saying, I mean, the contradictions in Donald Trump. I mean, he was pro-choice, now he's pro-life. You know, he was in favor of Obamacare. He wanted a system like Canada has. Now he's totally against it. I mean, but he's been given a pass because he's just such an entertaining, crazy character. But somebody like Scott Walker is going to have to answer the real
Walker
questions.
Has a lot of
and that's going to be, yeah, and that's going to be a tough
Oop.
Thing.
Walker. I mean, somebody said that Scott Walker makes Mitt Romney look like a model of consistency. He has changed his position on many things back and forth, and that's all going to be brought up in the campaign.
Platform that he's running on is actually really conservative, right? It's we like to think of Midwestern politicians as being a little more middle of the road, maybe even having a little bit of that sort of Midwestern populism going on. But he is, you know, I think when it comes out and when he finally picks a platform, it will be a very conservative one that will sort of lump him in with a number of other candidates.
And his strategist has made very plain and said publicly, we're going to go far to the right in the primary and try to win this thing, win Iowa, win New Hampshire, build from there, and then we're going to run in the middle and be very moderate against Hillary Clinton. And it's really easy to be a moderate later. Well, he may not get away with that, but we'll see.
I suspect there are a lot of Wisconsin Democrats who will make sure people don't forget his past. So this other guy is running. His name is Donald Trump. And I don't know if any of you read the Financial Times, but this weekend Gary Silverman had an op-ed article in which he was saying, in essence, he didn't use these words, but the Republicans or conservatives are reaping what they sowed in the sense that they've got this huge field of people that they wouldn't have if you didn't have so much money in politics right now, because any billionaire out there who wants to, you know, push a candidate will have their candidate, or like Donald Trump, will run themselves. Obviously, you have Democratic billionaires as well, Tom Steyer being one of them. But so what do you think about, would Donald Trump be a candidate if the Republican field wasn't so large and largely, for many of them, weak? I mean, the top polling Republican, I believe, is at like 19%.
Yeah.
You know, Hillary is well over 50% in
right.
her party. I shouldn't call her Hillary. Hillary Rodham Clinton, I mean.
The entire clown car is about 19%. Yeah, that's one of the steals. I actually have a Donald Trump story, if you'd like to hear it.
Always.
Years ago, when I was a sports columnist, I was
on Bill O'Reilly.
I was on Bill O'Reilly. Did I mention that already? Maybe I mentioned that.
In the green room at Bill O'Reilly.
I was covering the AT&T golf tournament, and Donald Trump had a hole-in-one. So I'm looking for a column. So I go out on the golf course and introduce myself on one of the holes.
This is at Pebble Beach?
It's at Pebble Beach, yes. And Donald Trump says, "The San Francisco Chronicle, come with me!" And he grabs me like this, and he has me walk down the middle of the fairway with him, and the marshals are all, "You'll have to get on." He says, "No, no, this is the San Francisco Chronicle." And I, and what I got out of it was, he's very comfortable with being a bit of a cartoon. Look at his hair. Right? I mean, and then I wrote a column about him, and he wrote a very nice letter to me back saying, "I always thought you seemed like a good guy, and turned out you were." And I had to say to myself, that was kind of fun meeting that guy. And I think that's our experience in the election. He's never going to get elected. I don't know if he really wants to be elected or not, but he certainly is an interesting diversion. And I would say he's making people make choices.
So you have this letter. You have the autograph of a future president there.
No, I sold it on eBay.
So he is making the other candidates stand up. I mean, one of the GOP candidates who is directly addressing Trump and what his effect is on the Republican Party and its policies is Senator Lindsey Graham. Mm-hmm. And, do you think he's rising in stature, if not
I think he's
support,
the one who's not going to get on the debate stage because he's not getting much traction. But he is playing the role, at least now, of saying, hey, this guy is bad for us. He's bad for the party. Everybody needs to denounce what he's saying. Everyone needs to speak up against this because he thinks it's bad for the party to alienate the Latino vote, which it is. Mm-hmm. And if Trump is driving the debate, that's not going to help the Republicans. It's going to tell the electorate at large, gee, this party is what you thought it was. But, you know, to answer your earlier question, I think Trump would be in this race no matter what because he's self-funded. So the proliferation after Citizens United of all the super PACs and all the other money doesn't affect him.
He's a one-man super PAC.
Yeah, there are other people who wouldn't be running if not for that. But I think if the mood struck him, he'd be in it anyway.
Okay.
I'm disappointed. If Lindsey Graham doesn't make it, I'll be disappointed because I would have liked to have seen the rotating first lady. Did you see that? He announced that he's not married. He's never been married. And he said he would have a rotating first lady.
I don't know. Spit? Or?
She would rotate.
But so. Also, only the first debate. The first debate is Fox, and it's in Cleveland, I believe. They're enforcing the standard of the top 10. But CNN, which is having the second debate in Simi Valley in Southern California, has, the last I heard, they may have changed this, they're going to do two debates. They're going to have the top 10, and they're going to have another one with the bottom six or seven by then.
I want to watch that one.
Who will get time, I think, after. I mean, just imagine. I mean, just the opening and closing statements, it's like, okay, our time's up. You know, that's it.
Someone in our audience writes, today on NPR, that's our audience, I heard Scott Walker described as having the political skill of Bill Clinton. Agree or disagree?
No.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. No.
If that, again, I think initially he's going to present really well. And then I think we're going to hear more from him, and I think more people are going to get more uncomfortable with what he's saying, and we're going to hear more from Wisconsin, which, as Doug said, is a divided
I mean, I've
Walker
been in a room with both of those guys. No, he doesn't hold a candle to Bill Clinton. He's not. He doesn't have that personal charm and charisma and magnetism, but he's a very good politician. I mean, don't underestimate him. Excuse me? Well, that too. But Scott Walker, he's a very good politician. He really is. But I don't see that in him. No.
Doesn't mean
he can't win. Bill Clinton didn't get 50% of the vote.
That's actually a good question. How do you think he would match up against Hillary? How long before she crushed him under her heels?
I think if the Republicans nominate someone as conservative as Scott Walker and Hillary is the nominee, she wins easily. That's what I think.
Okay. Well, someone asks, is anyone challenging Hillary Clinton? Democrats need fresh air.
Bernie.
They don't mean Terry Gross. So there is Bernie Sanders.
They may mean Terry Gross. It's an NPR thing.
That's right. Of course, there is Bernie Sanders running. There's Martin O'Malley.
Lincoln Chafee raised a whopping $29,000.
What?
In this quarter.
Wow.
Well, actually, let's kind of put out anyone else except Bernie Sanders, who has quite a bit of support. Is he a political threat to her, or is he just a friendly rival through the primaries?
Well, I think it reflects how boring it is that there's not really a race. I mean, I think people are eager to have some kind of a debate. She is clearly staying right in the middle of everything. She's triangulating everything. And he comes out, Bernie Sanders comes out with all these pronouncements and so forth, and it's kind of appealing. I get the strategy of trying to lock up the nomination early. I understand that's time-worn, that's a good idea, it works well, raise lots of money, but it isn't very exciting. And I think that we think of this as at the end of a two-term president, we're going to have an exciting, interesting debate on issues, on the direction of the country, and so forth. And I don't think we're seeing that right now with Hillary Clinton. So it's a tactic, but I think we may want to see somebody else. I don't know who you'd bring up, but
I think Sanders is pulling her to the left a little bit, and she's trying to co-opt some of his issues and keep too many people from, you know, the Elizabeth Warren vote, the Bernie Sanders vote. She'll move a little bit in that direction. He's getting huge crowds and good poll numbers, I think, because he represents the not Hillary candidate. Anyone who doesn't want to vote for Hillary or has reservations about her or wants to at least register now that they're not totally on board with her is going to him. So that's going to get him up to 25-30%, and it's going to force her to take him seriously. But I don't see him as a real threat to win the nomination.
I don't think she'll ever take him seriously. I mean, I think she'll see what it is. It's a blip.
It's the protest vote.
But what he has done is really sort of suck up all the air from everybody else, like Martin O'Malley. Who? What? Joe Biden? I don't know. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah, it's Hillary and Bernie. Like, that's it. Yeah, I mean, Webb announced. No one cared. He's really sort of occupied everything that's not Hillary in the Democratic primary. Look, in America, no one with who's a self-identified socialist is going to win overall. Okay, not right now. Okay, and I'm sorry for some of y'all that's upsetting. But
I mean, someone who's not a closeted socialist.
Yes, closeted socialist we're totally cool with. But you got to at least pretend to be a Democrat. So it's just, it really is a sort of a semantic issue to some degree. Like, it's just, that's not going to happen. But he's, you know, weirdly, and I don't want to make the comparison too closely, but like Trump, he is helpful in, you know, raising issues and being out there and making Hillary and, you know, those other people whose names we don't remember answer for the issues that he's bringing up. And I think the other thing, which is really incredible, is the crowds he's getting. I mean, there is a you know, every once in a while you'll read the New York Times, because I know y'all do, and there'll be some op-ed on there by some billionaire, like, you know, we got to be cool or else they're going to get the pitchforks, right? Every once in a while, there's one, maybe like twice a year, you get the, you know, economic inequality thing from the billionaires. But he's really tapped into something very, very powerful that I think, you know, just the exercise of that, just the spectacle of that, is like, you're on notice that, like, we don't have pitchforks yet, but, you know, they're in our back pockets. And so I think that the fact that he's been so popular, you know, is letting her know that she needs to, and not just her, but the Republicans as well, yeah, I mean, know that they need to adopt some more populist, more, you know, economically, you know, equal policies.
So there today, are, what, 21 people running now, or I think, or 22? He is getting the biggest crowds by far.
I mean, he might even win New Hampshire.
I mean, Hillary's not getting the crowds he's getting. None of the Republicans are getting the crowds he's getting. I mean, today, I think Jeb Bush was in Sioux City, Iowa. He had 240 people, and they thought that was a good turnout. Bernie's getting 10,000, 12,000. I mean, these incredible crowds, because there is a hunger for that kind of message at the moment.
Not to show my age, but he reminds me of Gene McCarthy, who was
John
at
Anderson, too,
John. Yeah, we had those guys that were older, gray-haired guys who were attracting some. And I think the one thing he's missing, if you carry the Gene McCarthy analogy out, is a single issue, a single unifying issue. He had the war. Mm-hmm. What does Bernie Sanders have? There's a discontent in the country. We're not sure what we want. The economy, immigration is going to be one of those things. But we don't have that single issue that's going to do it. But I would say it's interesting to hear rumblings from the Biden camp now. I mean, we understand that he went through a terrible tragedy and that was awful. But the idea, that seemed dead. And now suddenly we're thinking about it. And it makes me think that they're looking at Bernie Sanders and saying, you know, Hillary, you know, maybe it isn't a done deal. Maybe.
I think Joe Biden, I was just positioning that in case something happens with Hillary, he's there to step in. I don't see him taking on Hillary. He's got no structure or organization in place yet. It's a little late. I think he sees himself as a fallback.
Eternal,
he just doesn't want to give up.
Possibly that I'm really never going to be president? Yes. He always thinks there's one more shot.
Now, today Hillary Clinton did make her economic speech. What do we know about what she is proposing? How far do you think Bernie Sanders has pulled her or Elizabeth Warren, or this is the real Hillary. Anyway.
I mean, the thrust of her thing today, she actually went after Wall Street a lot more than people thought, especially considering how much money she's raised from, say, Goldman Sachs over the years. She really took it to Wall Street and said, you know, we need tighter regulation, we got to crack down on the shadow economy, and she talked about income inequality and raising wages, and she took on what she called the gig economy of Airbnb and Uber and said too many people are forced to do that. She called out Jeb Bush by name, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio by name, so I guess those are her top three as well, because those are the three she mentioned, and took them down a peg or two, and didn't really get very specific on how exactly she's addressing income inequality, what beyond we need higher wages and we need fair treatment for workers. There weren't a lot of specifics. She said she'd flesh that out, you know, in the weeks to come. But so I did hear a little bit more of that sort of Bernie Warren left populism than there was before.
Okay. One more before we move on to our next topic. Someone asks about Ohio Governor. Do you know who I'm going to say before I say the name? Oh, okay, he's got some name recognition. So John Kasich. What do we think about him?
To me, he's fourth in my top.
Really?
He's one down below the tier. But he's the kind of guy the pundits like, the reporters like, and never gets any votes. He's smart. You look at him, he's got all the things you need. Most people have never heard of him. He's coming in late. He's not showing in the polls, so he probably won't be in that first debate, and that's going to be a kiss of death. Mm. He's got an uphill battle. I think he's the kind of guy a lot of reporters who are out there covering the race think, oh, this is the guy you got to keep an eye on. But he ends up never getting traction. Mm-hmm. That's what I think of him.
Yeah. Okay.
And people say his name wrong. And,
yeah.
John.
Basic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
John.
They say Yowen. No.
Yeah.
Difficult. Well, let's talk about something that isn't really political. And by not really political, I mean it's not at all political, but I wanted to talk about it. And that is the U.S. women's national soccer team is the world champion right now. It's their third World Cup, which, by the way, the U.S. men's team does not even have one. So let's just take a bit of a victory lap with them, as well as talking a bit about, the economics of being a professional soccer player, if you're female, are completely different than they are if you're a male. What is it? The female professional soccer players get paid a small fraction of what male professional soccer players get, something like 40 times less. That's 40 times less. Their average pay is less than $10,000 a year, so they're working other jobs while they're playing soccer. That is, unless they're on the women's national team, there, I believe, their salaries are paid for by or subsidized by the federation. But we're still talking about people who are playing this game because they love the heck out of it. Mr. Former sports writer, take it away. Tell us what I mean, were you excited? Were you following this?
Yeah, I mean, I think my story with this is I've been married 30 years. When I met my wife 30-some years ago, she did not have the slightest interest in sports. In fact, when I would turn sports on TV, she would leave the room. We got married, we had kids. Our daughter played soccer for years and years and years. She became a fanatic fan. She was second-guessing the coaches. She was telling people what to do. Now when she watches the women play soccer, she gets so nervous, she leaves the room. So we've gone really 360 degrees, but it's the same. One of the things about the inequality in pay in women's sports is some of those games are a tough sell. It's hard to convince people to watch women's basketball, for example. Fast-pitch softball is, I'm sorry to say it, is deadly dull because the pitchers are so good you can't hit it. But soccer could work. Soccer could work. Those were great games. And it's almost a shame that the number of people who jumped on the bandwagon at the very last minute and only watched the last game, which was great, it was a wonderful celebration, but that was lopsided. The rest of those games were life and death. Those were fingernail biters. And those games made a lot of fans. And I think soccer is, I mean, this is not a revolutionary idea, but soccer is on the way. And women's soccer is as interesting and doesn't have the diving and the writhing in pain and all the theatrics that men's soccer have. I think that can be a sport that could make money, that could earn television revenue and make money for them.
The TV ratings for that final were as high as for the Warriors clinching game of the NBA title and for the Giants clinching game in the World Series. That's how big the audience was, and it was the largest viewership for any soccer match ever in American history. Now, if the men's World Cup team got that far, they would be even higher, obviously, probably threaten the Super Bowl numbers. Mm-hmm. But the people really got into it, and as you say, I agree with you about women's basketball. I can't watch it, but women's soccer, I enjoy as much as the men's.
Yeah, no, it really is.
No, what about
Melissa,
the only woman
defend
on the
women's basketball, please.
I don't play soccer. I'm one of those horrible people who showed up for the last game and was like, USA, okay, great. yay, we win. But look, it's advertising dollars, right? I'm glad the viewership was high because if you don't have the advertising dollars, then that's what translates into the salaries. But hopefully advertisers are out there, you know, looking at these numbers and, you know, being, you know, more willing to purchase packages for women's soccer next year.
And traditionally, they said advertising wouldn't work with soccer because it's two 45-minute halves and there's no timeout. There's no time to stop. But it works fine. They have ads before, they have it after, and they run some crawls beneath it. And if you get that kind of viewership, you're going to get advertisers. That's
and there, lots of the players, I feel like every commercial is a soccer player hawking something, which is great. So, yeah, good for them for capitalizing on that.
Well, and I would... Then we can go on to something else. But I would say the other thing about soccer is both the men and the women are average-sized people. They are very similar. It's not that hard to picture your daughter or your son or yourself playing soccer, where we've reached the point in professional football where those guys are almost freakish. I don't know what this muscle is right here, but I don't have that muscle. I don't know anybody that does.
Are you saying and I'm not going to get that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think, you know, I think it's very possible we're at a point where football and soccer may cross.
And the other factor in that is, youth soccer. So many kids play soccer. It's probably the most played sport for people's kids. So there's this natural fan base. They love it. They get their parents into it.
Very good. Well, someone asked about our next topic, so I'll just start with that. And that is the Confederate flag. Last time on a Week to Week, we talked about the fast-moving dismissal of the Confederate battle flag from public view in this country following the massacre of African-American worshipers at a South Carolina church by a young white man. This past Friday, South Carolina removed the Confederate flag from the grounds of its state capital. This effort was led by that state's governor, Republican Nikki Haley. Doug, how do you think the governor has handled this issue? I mean, is she a rising star?
Well, she was considered a rising star, and then she sort of was stagnant there for a while. I think she handled it very well and very quickly. I don't know that it really makes her more, I mean, someone will look at her as a possible running mate for president. She could run herself down the road. But I don't know. I don't think that's why she was doing it. I think she did handle it well. I was struck, yeah, how quickly that happened and how big a deal it was down there. I mean, people weeping in the streets. And I lived in the South for a little while, and I was often very uncomfortable with the racism. And seeing that flag made me uncomfortable because I always thought, wait, so this person, they wish the rebels won the Civil War. They support slavery. Why is this flag here? But I didn't really get the depth of feeling that so many people felt in the South on both sides of it. But I also was struck by, okay, this is the response to that shooting. Does anyone think there, really think, that, okay, we took down the flag, everything's fine now. There'll be no more shootings at churches. White people and black people will all love each other. And I just hope it's not like no one, I mean, it's real in that it's an important symbol, but did they really do anything real that's going to make a real difference? That was one of the things that bothered me about it.
That was one of the questions, actually, I had written out. I mean, Melissa, President Obama has always gets it from both sides of the spectrum whenever it's a racial, well, from no matter what he does, but in particular on racial issues, people have expectations he'll do something. He is Barack Obama. He's very deliberate and specific about what he says. He has had some of his best rhetorical moments in the wake of this massacre. And in the wake of the removal of the Confederate flag or the vote to remove it, he had some very, I thought, statesmanlike comments about, in other words, he wasn't trying to pick on the people who felt otherwise about him. He was really talking about this as a time for people learning about the other side and moving forward. Do you think he's handled this well, I mean, politically?
Oh, yeah, I think his approval numbers are very high. So I was born and raised in Marietta, Georgia. And literally, my parents were married on Kennesaw Mountain. And you wouldn't know this because if you're educated anywhere else, you wouldn't know about the specifics of Southern Civil War battles. But it was a very big battle fought on Kennesaw Mountain. And so literally in the background of my parents' wedding pictures are cannons, our Civil War cannons. I just mean, I'm steeped in this. So it was a huge deal.
And did they call it the War of Northern Aggression?
At times. Well, so I called my mom the other day, and so we were chatting about this. And she starts in with, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of heritage wrapped up in this. A lot of people died in the Civil War. And I'm already thinking, how do I get out of this? Because I do not want to disagree with my mom right now. I don't want to fight about this. I'm thinking we view this differently. And she goes on about how at her high school in North Georgia, Dixie was the fight song. And so, you know, all of these. And so as she's going, oh dear, how do I do this? And then she says, but when they took that, let me give my impression here. When they took the flag down, it felt like it made everybody more equal. And I just like almost cried. And I was like, oh, well, I did not think that you were going there with that. will it change race relations in the South? Probably not directly, not immediately. But it will, I think, you know, take away the incredible and legitimate objection that some people feel when they see that on the state house grounds. It's not banned from lunchboxes or like patches on your shirt or whatever. But if it's gone from the state house, you know, then maybe it's a little less it's less painful to drive by there and think about. Yeah, it's, look, here's the thing. In the South, and I'm going to tell a joke here, and I'm bad at joke telling, so just like forgive me. In the South, so there, you remember the Jeff Foxworthy used to have the "You might be a redneck if." Have you ever heard of these? You might be. Okay, so one of his, this is okay. Believe me on this. One of his jokes of "You might be a redneck" is, if your mama only takes a cigarette out of her mouth long enough to tell the state trooper to kiss her ass, you might be a redneck. And I love that because my mom doesn't smoke, just saying it. But it really, because it really articulates something about this sort of anti-authority sort of zeitgeist that a lot of people embrace down there. It's more, even if you're wrong, you're just, no one's going to tell you what to do, and I'm a butt kicker, and blah, blah, blah. Like, there is that. And I think for some people, that really is what the flag means. And I don't assume that everybody views it the same way. But so you've got this group of people who like this mascot of don't tell me what to do. Yeah. But then you've got a group of people who have legitimate objections to that. And those people who want the mascot have to give way to the people with the sincerely held and legitimate objections to the flag. And I think that that idea is the thing that's sort of getting more play, where people are understanding, you know what, whatever I love about this, it's really not worth what it's, you know, what it means for other people in for legitimate ways.
Does she know that Dixie was written by a Yankee? It's a beautiful song. Stephen Foster from Ohio, never been to the South in his life.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
You just ruined a lot of people's day with that.
Sorry. Right.
Who says you don't learn anything here? Before we move on, Chuck, what does Bill O'Reilly think about the Confederate flag?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
All right.
I wanted to touch on a couple things before we get into the news quiz. We talked rather at length last time on Week to Week about the Supreme Court decisions. There were massive ones. I won't make you go down that road all over again, except that there are still, there's a new case that bears watching, and Melissa had told us about before the program. Tell us about it. It involves unions and the CTA.
So the Supreme Court, you know, so like 3,000 cases get filed at the Supreme Court every year, and every year they only take like 70 of them. So it's a big deal to get like to be one of the few that gets picked. And recently the Supreme Court picked a case involving union dues and the California Teachers Association. Now this would have implications for other public unions elsewhere, but it's about the CTA. And basically in that case, let me back up for a second. When you're a member of the CTA, and if there's any members here, correct me if I'm wrong, there are sort of two buckets, right? There's sort of the I'm going to negotiate for better benefits bucket, and then there's the political action committee bucket. And so you have the choice. You can say, I don't want to contribute to your PAC stuff. I can just pay for my representation. What this case is about is whether this bucket, this representation bucket, is also political speech, and whether you can be compelled to sort of contribute to that political speech. They say, forget the PAC stuff. Like, we know you're not, like, officially contributing to our political stuff. But they say, every time you, CTA, go into the state capitol and you demand higher wages for your workers, that is a political act. And you are a very powerful political organization. And so by forcing me to pay even this part, that is a forced that's forced political speech that violates my free speech. Now, what's important about this case is that its implications are huge, right? That the Supreme Court over the years has chipped away a little bit time and time again at public employee unions' ability to collect dues. And if they rule in this case that you can opt out of the sort of bargaining part of the dues, then it's sort of a right to work, right? Everything becomes right to work, and you can't be compelled to pay for any union representation if you're a public employee, and that would decimate the coffers, potentially, of the CTA, although I'm sure a lot of people would choose to remain members and pay, but a lot of people wouldn't. And so the power of the CTA as a political entity in California is largely based not just on, you know, its goodness and rightness, as some people think, but also on its money. And so if it loses the money, it loses the power. The implications for this sort of go all the way down to legislation in California and how and where and what gets passed.
But with union representation, you have to pay, you can be a member or not a member, and it's a difference of, don't quote me on this 43 cents or something, it's taken out of your check every month. You don't have to be a union, you can't vote, but you're there for the representation because your salary will increase, your working conditions will be better. Mm-hmm.
I do think
really
it ties
important.
In as well with the change in not only the unions and the effect of unions and the effectiveness of unions, but also the millennials who have not grown up as a group of people that see the union as a definite positive. And I was just saying before the show that we just hired someone recently just right out of college, and our guild representative went over and said, now you'll want to be a part of the newspaper guild because we can represent you. And her first question was, do I have to pay dues or not? Is this optional or not? And I think you're seeing a younger generation that sees that, and also a generation kind of in the middle that says, I don't see unions being that effective. And it may be we're going to see a different type of union or a different manifestation of what they do, or they may be headed out the door.
Perhaps the unions could come up with an app for the iPhone.
Yeah. There we go.
And that would
a union
solve
app.
Everything.
It's true. Union membership in America was once, what, 40%? And now it's something like 11 or 13? 15?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he mentioned public unions. They're probably one of the larger sections of unionized workers still.
I mean, there's a lot of...
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Yeah. Okay. So, someone asks, Republican presidential candidates are, as we mentioned, are debating next month. What about the Democratic candidates? Are they having a debate?
They're going to debate. They're still putting together, I think they're planning on six. They're going to have debates. It'll be Hillary and Bernie and Jim Webb.
They should let Donald Trump in that
Lincoln
one, too.
Chafee. Yes.
Don't you think?
People will
good.
Watch the first one just to see how Hillary does and what happens with Bernie Sanders, and after that, they'll be so dull.
Okay.
I'm going to have to cover them.
Well, let's move on to our news quiz. For those of you who have never been here before, I will quickly describe how we do this. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know it, raise your hand. Last time, Joe Garofoli slapped people's hands if they just called out without raising their hand. I'll have to police this myself this time. He didn't slap their hands. He yelled at them.
Nice.
So I'll call on you. If you get the question right, we will give you some chocolate. Is my Fran, our chocolate lady, is here.
This is why it's not fair that we can't compete. I want chocolate.
Okay, so yes, the panelists don't get chocolate, so you're special. So our first question involves Malala, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Pakistani girl who was shot by the Taliban for advocating the right for girls to get an education. She's done something to further her goals. What did she do? She did this recently in Lebanon. Did you see it? Yes.
She opened another school for refugees in Syria.
Very good, very good. Yes, she opened a school for Syrian refugee girls.
She turned 18.
And she turned 18. She's no longer a girl. The school is funded by her Malala Fund, which is a nonprofit organization. Next question. Aha, this is a good one. Why is Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz feuding with the New York Times? I saw your hand first.
They will not put his book on the bestseller.
That's right. He claims a political motive for them not putting his book on the bestseller list. Next, following the removal, something we talked about today, following the removal from the state capitol grounds of the Confederate flag, what group ended its boycott of South Carolina this weekend?
Oh.
Did you see this? In the back, is that Norma?
The NAACP,
that's right. Very good. Ellen Powell, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the former venture capitalist who lost a highly watched discrimination suit earlier this year, resigned this week as CEO of what? And sir, I saw your hand first. You, yes. Reddit, that's correct. Fran, gentleman there in the white. Okay. I think that was number four.
Chocoholic over here.
Okay, so for those of you who keep close tabs on Mexican drug kingpins, this is for you. What happened to kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman on Saturday in the green there?
Yeah. Broken out of the prison for a mile-long time.
That's right. He escaped from a high-security prison for the second time. So can you raise your hand so Fran can see you? And it was a hole of 20. Okay. All I'm thinking is next time, don't put him on the ground floor. Okay, put his cell higher up.
Trump. Trump claims.
Yes. No.
And whose life has he or his son allegedly threatened?
Is this a quiz question?
This is a quiz question.
Donald Which Trump. Ask,
you'll get chocolate for this.
Donald Trump.
Did he really?
According to Trump.
He's everywhere.
Trump claims
he's threatened his life because of the things Trump is saying about Mexico.
Donald Trump tweeted a bunch of things about the escape, and then somebody alleging that they're the guy who escaped tweeted back, basically like, I'm going to get you, and like, I don't know. I don't speak Spanish, but I think there was a gay slur in there. I think he called him a gay person.
Back to the official questions. So Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and the Republican Party chairman had a phone conversation in which the chairman reportedly told him to behave. What is the GOP chairman's name? And sir, right there. Rince Priebus. That's right. Sounds like a Bond villain.
He's from Wisconsin.
That's right. He's from Wisconsin. We all have weird names in Wisconsin.
German Wisconsin name.
I think that was probably number 7. So,
would the panel like some of this?
The panel would not dream of accepting chocolate from taking it from a contestant.
I'm just hoping we can turn the heat up.
Okay, we'll go quickly so you can get back out in the nice fresh air. Which Republican governor running for president had to quickly backpedal after bipartisan outrage in his state over an attempt to curtail public access to state information? Did you see this story? Mm-hmm. We mentioned his name today. Do you want to guess?
Chris Christie.
Nope, good not guess, Chris Christie. Though. He's got other trouble.
It's always a good
we
guess.
Not even mention Chris Christie.
Anybody? Sir? Scott Walker is correct. So he had to backpedal on that, but he did get to destroy tenure for the university system there. That was in the budget he signed today. Fran, how many more do we have in there? Yes, I lost count. 3 more? Okay. Secretary of State John Kerry said the United States was willing to walk away from what tough talks if the deal was not right. If you've already won, don't raise your hand. Ma'am? The Iran nuclear deal, that's right. And what Nobel Peace Prize winner told Reuters that he sees, quote, no hope for peace in the Middle East, unquote? Jimmy Carter, that's right. Okay, last one. Yes,
white,
make sure Fran can find the victors here.
These two, right?
Final question. California Governor Jerry Brown signed the new state budget in dollars to the nearest $100 million. How big is the budget?
General fund or total fund spending?
That's
general fund,
question.
Let's say.
Yeah, that's a wonky question.
Anybody want to guess? Within a billion. How? Anyone want to guess? You already won, sir. Your lucky Joe is not here. Oh, you people are cheap. Come on. This is California. Wow. This is the state that when we were in the hole, we had a deficit of like 70 or 80 billion.
39 billion.
No. In the back there, sir. 100 and what?
107. Close.
I'm going to give it to you. It's $115.4 billion. That's dollars, not lira or...
Drachmas.
Yes, not drachmas. Well, listen, everybody, we're going to have more quiz questions and a lot more to talk about in 2 weeks on Monday, July 27th at our next week-to-week political roundtable. Thank you to our panel, Melissa Griffin-Kane, Doug Sovereign, and Chuck Nevious. Thanks to all of you here and everyone listening in the audience, online, or on TV. Have a great week. We'll see you next time. Try to stay cool.